From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 17th installment in our series with Professor Luciana Bone, taking a look at the history and the political economy of the world's first socialist state, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, or USSR, more commonly known as the Soviet Union. Luciana, it's a pleasure to have you back. I'm really enjoying this series of discussions, as our listeners are. I'm getting a lot of positive feedback. And I guess we had promised we would pick up. We were discussing the Spanish Civil War. Towards the end of our conversation, we got to a point where you had listed the grouping of various tendencies on the right that's, you know, successfully unified to seize power. And I had made an observation that this stands in contrast to the, what the left usually does, that for some reason the right is able to act in a unitary way and settle their scores with the left first and then fight with each other, whereas the left fights with itself first and then never gets to the second phase.
Sadly, yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's good to be back with you talking. I enjoy it too. And I'm so pleased that you're getting positive responses.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, well, okay. The left...
I guess what we're talking about, I guess what we're talking about is that it seems that the right has no compunction about who it allies with, as long as it understands, you know, within a strategic context, that tactical alliances help to win the day, and that you can settle the differences with your allies, quote unquote, after you defeat your enemies. Whereas the left almost seems that I can't engage with you unless you pass an ideological test in the first place, which means I'm going to be fighting this battle alone if I decide I'm worthy.
Because I have my own theory.
Yes, yeah.
Of how to bring socialism about.
Exactly.
But of course, the Comintern, the 1935 Comintern, International Communist Parties, which delegates of, which met in Moscow in 1935, proposed such a unity within the United Front, which would gather all classes in the fight of, against fascism.
Right.
So the proposal, under the guidance of the Soviet Union, of the Comintern, was unity.
Yeah, I mean, so this is the big sin, too, that the, you know, various leftists point to Stalin and the party at that time as, you know, they're not up to the ideological snuff because they're willing to ally themselves with bourgeois forces, with socialists with contrary tendencies, et cetera, et cetera. The big sin, in other words, is that they're willing to unify to win.
Yeah, the National, what did I say?
Oh,
the
National Front.
Front.
Yeah,
not the National Front. The United,
United Front. Yeah, yeah.
Here, that's National Front is Franco forces.
Right.
Yeah, the main communist, you know, the only communist state in the world, one-sixth of the world, which was the Soviet Union, gather the Comintern parties, the Comintern, I'm repeating what I just said.
Yes.
There was a decision made that fascism must be fought along a united front.
Right.
Okay?
That's
now,
right.
What was the left, what left opposed this?
Mm.
Okay, so that's...
Yeah. That's worth having that conversation.
Is it a left even?
Right. No pun intended.
Okay, we're having a little joke here, but
You know, it's interesting because just to digress for a moment, and I think this is the part that's relevant to this particular moment that we're living in now. The theory behind it was that if the fascists gain power, there will be nothing left. to, you know, in the aftermath to fight over, that, you know, human civilization may well end up being destroyed. And so the revolution, you know, the development of human society towards communism will be thwarted because humanity may well end. And now, of course, that is even more possible. We have nuclear weapons. They're deployed to the borders of Russia and China. We have maniacs that are discussing how to use them, and an open fight in the U.S. government now over who's going to get to push the button. We've never had that before. That's actually going on now.
Yes, and of course, this is what the argument I would make, is that unless the left, whatever it is or claims to be, unites against war, which is a real threat.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, we are in the same condition we were in the 1930s, and that is that we have to oppose the version of fascism that we have today, which is this international ambition to, on the West, on the part of the West, to own the world. I mean, these are the heirs of fascism, these ideas.
Right. Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
So even the ecologists should be able to acknowledge that war has devastated, that in the battlefields of the First World War, some areas are still off limits because of the poisons, and that's 100 years.
Yep.
And all we have to think about is Vietnam.
Yeah, for sure.
And the poisons there, and everywhere, you know, and everywhere else where we drop poison. So
and not only that. And by the way, you know, we just saw on the news today in Cambodia some other ecological legacy from that war is that there's a lot of places you can't walk in Cambodia without blowing up.
Yeah,
I would consider that environmental pollution also.
Yes, and in Vietnam the same thing. And some good American soldiers who had fought in Vietnam are there, what do you call it, defusing the bombs.
Right, that's right, yep, because they're all over the place. And of course, you have that all over the Middle East as well. They've been dropping mines and, you know, and whatever else everywhere. And those open pits that they burn. And the other thing is that apparently in the normal operation of human society and global economy, the largest single source of pollution of all kinds is the U.S. military. So, you know, that's without fighting a war.
Yeah, so that's right. Okay, focusing on what happened in Spain between the lefts. So, you know, now I begin with this statement. There was a civil war in Spain. But we have to remember that there were Moscow trials, charges of treason against the Trotskyist plotters.
Right.
And this is highly... Okay. Oh, I have to just focus. I would like to propose the idea that within the Spanish Civil War, that from the Spanish Civil War, with the experience contemporaneous of the Spanish Civil War, it was the Moscow trials acknowledge a civil war within the Soviet Union.
Right.
Okay. Now, because out of the Spanish Civil War came a mythology that the Stalinist Soviet Union had crushed the social revolution of the anarchists and Trotskyists to please Britain and France, and that the Soviet Union had failed to support the nationalist mobilization in Spanish Morocco, which, in the eyes of these mythologists, might have weakened Franco's army. So, well, okay, let me continue. But the Soviet Union learned valuable lessons from the Spanish Civil War too. That these charges came from a fifth column. What they call a fifth column.
Right.
And of course, these forces were the anarchists and the Trotskyists. And he learned, too, that the rise of a similar fifth column in Spain had to be the rise of a similar fifth column in Russia or in the Soviet Union had to be blocked in the Soviet Union itself if the coming assault by Hitler had to be repelled. So this is how, and this is my theory, okay? I think it's hinted, perhaps, but I have never seen it spelled out. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It's just that my research has not gone that far. It's just beginning. So what am I saying here? That in the Spanish Civil War, which was occurring at the same time as the Moscow trials of 36 and 37, against the treason of part of the military and the left opposition, are connected. That there are. Can you elucidate on what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You're so concise because I'm just developing this, so I'm very, you know, hesitant.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and it's very complex too, and you're pointing to the complexity of it by tying these two things together.
You know,
you have on the one hand Stalin and those in the party who were the dominant, dominant members among the inner circle. In other words, who's the people that were making the actual policy that was being implemented. And for all of the massive propaganda that was being employed against it, you know, this was a, to step out of it for a second, this was an existential threat to global capitalism. The idea that a backwards, you know, like 10 minutes ago, feudal society could, within a generation, become a modern state based upon a workers' order, a socialist order that did not involve capital. This idea was not only heresy, but it was the kind of heresy that we saw with the Reformation with Martin Luther. It was an existential threat to the existing order. And so everything was being done to see that this was not actualized. And where they couldn't stop it from being actualized, everything was being done. New technologies, in fact, were being invented in order to misrepresent it to humanity so that its obvious contagious properties could be contained. In other words, if workers in a backwards feudal rural country like Russia was devastated at the end of 1917, 1918, if they could turn around and build a modern state as workers and without a bourgeoisie driving it, without capital exploiting them, then this is something that made every other worker in the world a candidate for the thought, gee, we don't need these guys either. And so all the stops were pulled out. And among those things, you had, first you had the war that was, you know, going on from the moment the Bolsheviks took power from the West, the U.S., the U.K., the French, the Germans. Everybody had troops in Russia, around Russia. They had saboteurs blowing up things. People would, you know, organize, build a factory out of dust practically, and then suddenly, oops, it blew up. You know, when they'd find out that, the, you know, some guy smuggled something in from Germany or whatever. So there was a massive assault against this effort. The entire construction of the Soviet state occurred under a condition of siege. I'm only touching the, you know, barest points on that particular thing. And so inside the government as well, there were plenty of people who were either agents of, you know, these parties outside, or had their own ideas about, well, with such concentration of state and economic power in a few hands, I could end up being the next czar. And they were competing on that basis as well. So in that climate, you had, you know, the inner party circle steering both the government and the economy to a position that ended up allowing them to defeat Hitler. And in less than 40 years after the revolution, in the conditions I described before, go into outer space ahead of the whole of the rest of humanity. Those people were under attack from people inside the party and inside the Soviet Union, behind mainly Trotsky, who was attacking it ostensibly from the left. Now, you have a leftist state that is being successfully constructed, and you have someone who's saying, no, you can't do that. That is supposed to be a critique from the left. But in fact, it was a critique from the right, because the attack was from the right, and this was one of the modes of attack.
Yes, I'm deviating from this exciting summary from you. I want to add that the threat to the capitalist world was the success, the economic success of the Soviet Union.
Yep.
The political turmoil, I argue, by the mid-1930s, that is the trials and all that, the political
a struggle. Did you say struggle? Use a generic term,
That was the result of the encirclement of the threat from within in Russia.
Yep.
From within Russia, of they were sabotaging the factories.
Yep.
They were colluding with the Nazis.
Yep.
They were people. I mean, I think it's legitimate to call it a second civil war. There was a civil war.
Yeah, it's difficult to say that it was a second civil war, because it's kind of hard to figure out when the first one ended and the second one began, because there was a state of siege from the ab initio.
Yeah. So within this political fracture, that was a kind of it was real in Russia. It was undercover in the West, the civil war in Russia.
Right.
What the propagandists in the West did was seize on the political facet of the development of the Soviet Union and created a mythology around that, ignoring the economic development under extreme stress.
Right.
So when the left outside Russia ignores the economic advances and social advances and focuses on the political repression that they call repression, they are not left. I think the line of the left is whether or not you support the development of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I mean, look.
The line there. Go ahead.
No, that's right. I think the thing that really conveys the essence of it is the actual, point of contention or point of divergence between what was being followed in the USSR with Stalin and others, Bukharin, and that which was the criticism. The policy that was adopted was essentially an acknowledgement of the fact that the revolution in Germany didn't happen, that there was no revolution in the United States or in the UK or any place else. And so the idea of global revolution happening and Russia following was abandoned in favor of the reality that the working class and peasants held power in the Soviet Union and not anywhere else. So they would build socialism in one country. And that was the policy that was being followed. And that was criticized by Trotsky and others as being impossible and counter-revolutionary. In other words, the reality of it is they were saying, you can't do this, you have to have a bourgeois state and wait for the rest of the world to catch up.
And the argument also was, if we can let socialism survive in the Soviet Union, it will help the rest of the world's communist parties, the rest of the world.
Right, but
it didn't mean that they were isolated.
Right.
Anyway.
Right.
But let's see how this drama between what I call an authentic left and a deluded, extravagant, romantic, obstructive left. All of those things apply, all of those adjectives.
Yep.
You know, what is this other left? The one that opposes the Soviet Union? Or what are their goals? What are their ideas? And this played out very well, not very well, actually, but this played out in Catalonia. So let's look at it. Now, we have two forces that opposed the Soviet Union in the Spanish Civil War, the anarchists and the Trotskyists, the PUM, which argues that it wasn't Trotskyist, but we, you know, the ideas were there. So we have these two anti-Soviet, you know, that called the Soviet Union counter-revolutionary, the anarchists and the Trotskyists. So the anarchists in Catalonia entered the governing institution of the state, contrary to their dogma, to defend Catalonia against the Falangists. They eventually joined the government. And how did they help to govern? Well, by the evidence, by obstructing the class unity of the United Front. So both anarchists and Trotskyists opposed the United Front. And why? Because it was issued by the Soviet Union, which they call counter-revolutionary. All right, so by obstructing the class unity of the United Front and basically defying the consensus of the Comintern, this is your left of 1935. Requiring solidarity among the anti-fascist forces, including the middle classes. You know, the anti-fascist middle classes. So, what did they do? They proceeded, the anarchists in particular, their CNT trade union, they proceeded to institute a social revolution. So what were the measure and effect of this social revolution? This is, you know, these are the anti-Stalinists who propose something better, than something more effective in their eyes of the United Front. Okay, so throughout Catalonia, many sectors of the economy fell under the control of the anarchist CNT, the trade union, and which united with socialist UGT trade unions. And here, worker self-management. Workers' self-management was implemented. And this is called by people like Noam Chomsky the revolution. This is called the revolution, and see what happens. Self-management included railways, streetcars, buses, taxi cabs, shipping, electric light and power companies, gas works and water works, engineering and automobile assembly plants, mines, mills, factories, food processing plants, theaters, newspaper, bars, hotels. Never mind. Trade union control spread to small businesses of the middle classes. Artisans, handicraftsmen, and tradesmen. This is your petty bourgeoisie.
Right, that's right. It's a libertarian socialism, essentially. What they were calling social revolution was establishing, in essence, a libertarian socialism, like a sort of a petty bourgeois anarchism.
And this is socialism imposed by above.
Right, exactly.
By an organization called the CNT.
Right.
And they accused the Soviet Union,
of imposing,
the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, of ruling from above.
Right, exactly.
And they're doing the same, you know, the same thing they they accuse the others of doing, which... Right. Okay, so in Barcelona, the CNT collectivized the sale of fish and eggs, slaughterhouses, meal processing. They socialized them. And they tried to persuade the members of the middle class and the small bourgeoisie to join the revolution. Think about, which we will talk next week, think about how the Soviets organized. They weren't organized top-down as it's maintained by the Bolsheviks. They arose on their own.
That's right.
And we'll talk about that. That's a myth about the Soviets being, the Soviets, the Workers' Council, being a kind of... plot of the Bolshevik Party or an initiative.
No. First came the councils, then came the Soviet state.
Yes.
Okay.
It wouldn't have been possible, but look at the contradictions here. They go and convince the middle classes, whereas it's the opposite. The Soviets put pressure on the Bolshevik Party.
That's right.
To act. We'll talk about that next time. And these classes were generally unwelcoming to being expropriated, essentially, of their businesses under force or threat of force. In other words, there was chaos within chaos. And so how did this social revolution work out? Well, Orwell celebrated it in homage to Catalonian, but we have testimonials from a CNT member, which kind of is representative. Alberto Perez Baró describes the initial economic confusion. After the first few days of euphoria, the workers returned to work, he wrote, and found themselves without responsible management. This resulted in the creation of workers' committee in the factories, workshops, and warehouses, which tried to resume production with all the problems that the transformation of this kind entailed. And mind you, this was happening in the middle of a civil war.
Right.
This damn stupid revolution, which divided the United Front.
Right.
And divided the classes and antagonized them and put them one against the other. This does not seem sensible to me. Mm-hmm. So, owing to inadequate training and the sabotage of some of the technicians who remained, many others had fled with their owners, workers' committees were improvised and had to rely on guidance of the unions. This is top down again.
Yep.
So, and they, lacking training in economic matters, the union leaders began to issue directives that spread confusion in the factory committee and enormous chaos in production in the middle of a civil war.
Which allowed not only its defeat by Franco, but Franco was the last of the fascist dictators to lose power some 25 years after World War II. And we're going to come back to this next week, because the way that they explain what happened to continue this trend is that it was the Communist Party of Spain and Stalin that essentially sabotaged it by discouraging the creative spirit that had, been released by these events. And I guess they were really effective because they so discouraged it that Franco held power till the 1970s. It's such a ridiculous quote-unquote analysis that it doesn't really warrant much more than passing reference. But, Luciana, thank you very much. We'll pick it up here next week, and... again, I'm really enjoying this. I know our audience is, and most importantly, I think this is something that is extremely needed at the moment with what's happening in the world. So thank you.
Thank you, Don. Bye-bye.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.